in the KSRO kitchen. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
And we haven't seen this gentleman in about 3.5 years.
Something like
and
that.
And he's come back
when
to St. Louis.
When did you come in here last, your last book?
I think it was November 2016.
Okay.
And this
okay.
is Paul Friedman, who wrote The 10 Restaurants That Changed America, one of our, wouldn't you say, favorite books of many years?
Yeah. Because it made us think and remember. It's like, oh, I do remember that. And also find out things that we never knew.
Paul's,
you do it in such an elegant way, you know, gossip.
Yes, well, thank you.
Paul's new book is American Cuisine and How It Got That Way. You are still teaching at Yale?
I am. I considered retiring, and for a number of reasons, not yet.
Did you start working on researching this book shortly thereafter the publication of the first book?
Yes, they're devoted to, in a way, the same topic, which is, what is American cuisine, and is there such a thing as American cuisine, and if so, what is it?
And that's what you asked in the opening of the book, that a lot of people feel that there is no such thing as American cuisine.
Or they think that there's American food, like peanut butter, but that there's no cuisine in the sense of a set of rules that people adhere to.
And often, especially Europeans, were so derisive of, you know, they thought we were just a bunch of savages when it came to food. And as you point out, in some instances, they were correct.
Yes, or they would say, you have all sorts of different foods, but there's no American food. I think their attitude has changed a little bit in recent years. Now our eclecticism is cool. So when food trucks came to Paris, I read an article that said they were referred to or considered to be très Brooklyn, very Brooklyn-like. Well, even though Brooklyn's not the place in New York for food trucks, the idea that you have tacos from one and, Middle Eastern food from another and pad thai from another. Formerly in France, that would have been hideous.
And then the fusion of those things, Korean tacos.
Even more. I'm not sure they're up to that.
But it turns out that American cuisine is pretty much influencing a lot of European cuisine.
That's right. And it's not the way it was thought to be, say, 20 years ago, where the fear was that the world would be McDonaldized. That's not actually what's happening. What's happening is a kind of eclecticism that's exported from America. So in the book, I think I have a picture of a sign advertising a restaurant in Poitiers, France. And it says, try some typical French food, burgers, paninis, tacos.
That's great.
Three ways of looking at American cuisine.
So, you know, in the very beginning of the book, actually, it was in the introduction, and I think this talks to this idea of how the world has seen, maybe they don't see it so much that way anymore, has seen American food. You quote from Andre Simon, it was called An American Tragedy, which I thought was sort of interesting. And he was quite a prolific and very influential writer during that time. And he identified the three false gods of American dining: speed, sugar, and shows. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The notion has been for a long time that Americans don't really enjoy food. They regard it as a necessary chore, or they regard it as a threat, you know, because diets are so popular. And so you see this particularly with lunch. Americans tend to like to do something else during lunch, work or walk or... The notion of setting lunch aside as a time for pleasure is alien to America. So speed has been one of the things we're criticized for. Sugar, there's no doubt that Americans consume a huge amount of sugar, and it's not so exclusively in the form of sweets or sodas. Nobody else in the world likes sweet salad dressings the way we do, or barbecue sauce, which is both sweet and spicy. Yeah. Or glazed ham, or honey mustard, all of these things, or General Tso's chicken, right? Sweet and sour dishes in China actually have a sour component. whereas our sweet and sour Chinese food, we just skip the sour. So
and then portion size was mm-hmm.
portion size indeed. So shows, I would say that's less true than in Simon's time. When what he's writing about are restaurants that have sort of a spectacle. We still mm-hmm. spend, certainly in New York more than anywhere else, millions of dollars on atmosphere, on lighting, on gimmicky things. I guess maybe Las Vegas more than New York.
Noise.
Noise is part of the show, definitely. Yeah. But we're not as big into funny Chinese decor or bands or mariachi bands in Mexican restaurants mm-hmm. as would have been true, say, in the 40s or 50s.
In the first part of the book, you focus on three American cuisines. Talk a little bit about the first one, New England cuisine, how that was the cuisine and how it's declined as far as its importance.
So in the first part of the book, I talk about regionalism, which is one of the responses to the statement, there is no such thing as American cuisine. Oh, what about our wonderful regional food? And there is no single American cuisine. Some regions have maintained themselves into the 21st century, but most regional cooking, and New England here is typical, has not really survived. In the 19th century, there was a whole set of New England traditions, dishes, methods of preparation. Clam chowder is sort of like all that's come out of that. Or things like lobster rolls that are associated with New England and are delightful, but are not home-cooked items. They're things that people buy, just like pizza is not a home-cooked product either. So New England is an example of food that became kind of extinguished.
You described it as the first forgotten cuisine, which I thought was, whoa.
harsh, yeah. But true. So, I mean, who makes Boston baked beans for, 8 hours in the oven anymore? Who makes red flannel hash? This appears in all kinds of typical New England food books, and now would be unknown to 99% of us. On the other hand, in that same section, I talk about Louisiana food, which has, although threatened, managed to survive and even in certain respects flourish. So there's some regions that have maintained themselves.
You mentioned in that section nostalgia and appropriation, the South. And in that, you talk about the different regions within Southern food. There's not just one Southern food.
That's right. And then there's some Southern foods that have become, to use an overworked term, iconic, like fried chicken. There's some Southern foods that are iconic but not really exported. So grits are still not very popular outside the South, but everybody knows what they are. Mm-hmm. There are lots and lots of Southern dishes that nobody eats anymore in the South or anywhere else. So beaten biscuits, which require an insane amount of work for a rather ordinary product, or game. So a lot of Southern cookbooks will have recipes for squirrel or possum, but they're not made as much as they used to, it's fair to say.
The third of those, which I thought was interesting, is, I guess, South, but you pointed out as maybe it's the one that has endured, you just mentioned that, is New Orleans Creole Cajun cuisine.
That's right,
Which has kept its identity more than the other two.
Probably Cajun more than Creole, because Creole is really French and elegant and now considered slightly old-fashioned.
Mm-hmm. Within the South, you point out the resurgence, or at least recognition, of Appalachian food, which seems to be pretty hot now.
So I've been in Appalachia a fair amount recently, and what people are actually eating, as opposed to the centers of taste and culture, is still, I mean, it's fascinating because it runs the gamut from they're still shooting, dressing, and eating small game. They, on the other hand, that's the place where you can find 1950s dishes that elsewhere are extinct. So I've had Butterfinger layer cake in Tennessee. This is made with crushed Butterfinger candies, Cool Whip, and cake in layers.
I remember that from White Trash Cooking.
Yeah.
No, I'm not kidding. But, because
yeah,
you
this is a book that I describe, but it is that sort of thing, except that I think that book would certainly have a lot of Cool Whip, but the other ingredients would be from cans, so like a five-can fruit salad.
Yeah, it's interesting because when that book came out, John, it was 1986. We started the show in 1987, and we kind of laughingly reviewed the book. But then in hindsight here, 30-plus years, there was a very serious component to that book that was authentic.
That's right. That's right. And despite the term white trash, which is not favored anymore, the kind of poor people's cooking is at that point identified with both traditionalism, the sort of thing. When I lived in Tennessee from 1979 to 1997. So when I came there, which was before white trash cooking, poor white rural people were made fun of because they had chickens in their backyard and they put up stuff they grew from their gardens over the winter. Now, of course, rich, well-off people, if they don't have the chickens in their backyard, pay someone else to have their chickens in the backyard. And the stereotype of the rural poor is obese, fast food addicts. So the continuity is the notion that the poor eat the way they do because they're uneducated. The difference is in attitudes towards fresh and homemade ingredients.
You know, there's a line, though, that dovetails onto that, and that is you wrote class more than race influences what people eat.
And even more than location. Right. So that I discuss so-called community cookbooks, cookbooks put together by local churches or junior leagues or other charitable organizations. And for most of them, you can't tell where they are unless you look at the cover. They've got the same hamburger stroganoff or jello salads or three bean salads or quiche, depending on the decade.
That was a fact. Well, let's jump in to that when we come back from this break.
Yeah, and all the characters that you uncover.
Paul Friedman's new book, American Cuisine and How It Got This Way, some 360 pages. It's a great read. Paul's the author of 10 Restaurants That Changed America. That's the last time Paul spent some time with us in the KSRO kitchen. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash. This is KSRO.
Sonoma County's FM News Talk at 103.5 and 94.5. KSRO, depend on it.
Hi, Austin here from More Home Services, and here we are in another new year. I know it's easy to be a little cynical about New Year's resolutions. It seems like the best intentions to get in shape, make more money, or just be a better person always seem to fall by the wayside. But let me encourage you a little bit. Don't listen to the negative voices telling you that you can't do it. I know it's hard, especially if those voices are coming from people you love, or worse, from inside your own head. But here's the truth. You can do it. You have the strength, you have the courage, and you have the determination. Just don't listen to the negativity. Think of all the times in your life when you have succeeded. Think of the person you want to become. Then focus every single day on the small steps you need to take to get where you want to go. Because you know what? I'm here to tell you, you can do it. This is Austin from More Home Services. You can find us at morehomeservices.com.
Does healthy eating habits fit into your New Year's resolution? Then shop the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market for fresh, local produce. It's important to know where your food comes from, and you can meet the local farmers and ranchers who raise quality, locally grown food products for you to enjoy. At the market, you can savor a variety of delicious prepared foods. The market offers fresh local ingredients for healthy dinners, a variety of quality meats from beef, chicken, and pork to seafood, along with seasonal fruits and vegetables. Taste the local goat cheeses from Two Rock Valley Goat Cheese. Sample the wonderful baked goods, jams, spices, and pastas. Everything you need to create memorable healthy dinners is at the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market. Open year-round, rain or shine, Saturdays, 8:30 till 1 p.m. at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun.
2019 is your year to stop smoking once and for all. At tomorrow's Mark Patrick Hypnosis Seminar in Santa Rosa, you can finally become a lifelong non-smoker. Regardless of your past experience or how long you've been smoking, this program is designed so you can stop smoking without anxiety, irritability, or weight gain. For only $49.99, you can become a non-smoker through hypnosis tomorrow at the Flamingo Resort Hotel and Conference Center, 2777 4th Street, Santa Rosa. Seminar from 2 till 4. Registration starts at 1:30. Seating is limited, so get there early to reserve your spot. All forms of payment are accepted. More information, go to markpatrickseminars.com. Over 500,000 have attended their program. Join the Mark Patrick Seminar tomorrow, the Flamingo Resort Hotel and Conference Center, 2777 4th Street, Santa Rosa, and use the power of hypnosis to stop smoking now.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
In the KSRO kitchen, Paul Friedman, author of the just-released American Cuisine and How It Got This Way. Paul's the author of 10 Restaurants That Changed America. We left off talking about regional cuisine, the influence of New Orleans cuisine, which is still viable, the rise of Southern cuisine, the decline of New England cuisine as far as being influential in America.
Well, and the next chapter under that thing was something you called culinary nostalgia. And this is this cast of characters, some of which I had heard of. I was vaguely aware of what they did, but I didn't realize they so influenced our feelings about food and about regionality. And one of those was Mark Twain, of all people.
Mark Twain traveled a lot. And in Germany, he wrote a kind of nostalgic or longing list of foods that he missed from the United States, 70 or so dishes, many of them regional. So New England clam chowder, mm-hmm. Southern fried chicken, many of them rather humble, chitlins, possum, raccoon, bacon and greens. But this
and some odd ones like celery.
Yeah.
It was on that list.
Yeah, or even ice water. It is true that Americans like ice water more than people in other countries who will drink water without the ice. Americans like ice generally. But he also can't stand certain things in Germany, like the coffee or dairy products. He says the cream is never any good. So some of this is just homesickness, mm-hmm. but what it is he's homesick for is very interesting, because in 1870s when he wrote this, there still was a kind of non-industrial American cuisine. It's right on the point at which processed food is starting to make itself felt.
So would you talk about Duncan Hines? I remember growing up that was a mark, a place recommended by Duncan Hines was, you know, that's a place you want to go. But he was quite a, and beyond cake mixes and cornbread mix and things like that that stole his name. But he was quite an influential person.
Well, they didn't steal his name. He sold his name.
Did
so
he?
That for many of your listeners, they identify Duncan Hines as the random name of a cake mix. Mm-hmm. But there was a real Duncan Hines who, beginning in the 1930s, wrote the first national guidebooks mm-hmm. for dining. He had been a salesman and compiled for his friends at first a list of nice places in a sea of greasy spoons and mm-hmm. unpleasant truck stops. His standards were very much hygiene, atmosphere. He was not very big on, at least his persona was an aw shucks kind of guy, typical good-natured American. So he didn't recommend unusual food. He was, he admired Chinese food. He said that Southern food wouldn't be any good without, well, really, the African-American influence. His favorite food, however, was Midwestern and plain, copious, wholesome. But he did create a kind of annual guide to fine dining, but fine dining of a rather middle class sort.
You mentioned many other people that I just had a vague understanding and just knowledge about. The first full-time cook restaurant reviewer for The New Yorker, who I had never heard of her, and she was quite influential too.
Yes. So at that time, The New Yorker didn't really identify its authors as much as it did later. But Mrs. Hibben wrote Guides to American Regional Food, and they're crucial because the first one in the 1930s sees the regions as flourishing. The second one, after the war, laments the rise of kind of chains, homogeneity, and the Americans' pursuit of convenience and science over actually good food. And so these writers all either were trying to say, behind the highways and the big cities is a wonderful, lusty American food tradition, or to lament the passing of that lusty American food tradition. So their attitudes are different, optimistic versus pessimistic, but their diagnosis of where to find American food and what the enemy of American food is are similar.
So you mentioned also, which influenced me directly, I think because my mom subscribed to it, were the Time Life books, which I really did try to take a deep, deep look into the regional food of America.
They did. And,
the rest of the world.
They were an incredibly serious enterprise.
And I still have the whole set.
I do too. My mother also subscribed to it. So for something like Latin America at the time, there was nothing as comprehensive. The volume for Africa is somewhat disappointing, partly because it's by a South African who has a rather, to put it mildly, patronizing attitude towards black Africa. Nevertheless, nobody else had as comprehensive a look at food or integrated recipes with culture the way that series did. And they had six volumes dedicated to the United States. But what makes them kind of comical, even at the time, is they have no interest in showing the threats to American cuisine. It looks as if we're still a hardy land of horse riders, pioneers, doughty fishermen, and that James Beard, who wrote the introduction to the first volume, uses the word bounty a lot, as if this is a newfound land of wonderful creativity, when in fact in 1970, when these were published, it was a land of fast food, highways, and here and there a few survivals.
So in the next chapter, you talk about community cookbooks, which I just love because there are a couple of recipes. One was the spaghetti recipe.
That calls for boiling it for like 40 minutes and then baking it, right.
Yeah. And putting it in it and then layering it with cheese and tomatoes and all of that.
Right. And not, you know, Reggiano Parmigiano cheese either, but as I recall, grated American or something
like
that.
And the other one was the ginger ale salad.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a staple with community cookbooks all over the country. There was a Coca-Cola salad as well. So these also have Jell-O in them. And community cookbooks are the cookbooks put out by charitable organizations, particularly churches and Junior League and the like. What they're supposed to be is cheap and easy, not too regional, not too sophisticated. If you think about the women who put them together, and they were largely the products of groups of women, if you spoil the curve by having something that either requires too much work, like skinning a deer, or so the typical dish would be hamburger stroganoff.
Got it. We need
hamburger stroganoff is elegant but simple.
I would love to see a copy of the American Pakistani cookbook from 1955 that you talk about in there. We'll take a break. We have a lot to cover. Another couple big chapters. Part two is modernity, how everything changed, the golden age of, I think you say, food processing from 1880 to 1970. Paul Friedman in the KSRO kitchen today. His new book, American Cuisine and How It Got This Way. Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash at the KSRO kitchen.
Join the switch to crystal clear KSRO-FM, 103.5 Santa Rosa, Windsor, 94.5 Petaluma. Hear the difference.
The largest investment you'll most likely ever make is your home. At a median housing price of $398 per square foot, you have the opportunity to maximize your investment with a room addition. And the most cost-effective, energy-efficient way is by contacting the team at Sonoma County Sunrooms. Sonoma County Sunrooms, or SoCo Sun, is an authorized four-season sunroom dealer right here in Santa Rosa. They work with homeowners and property owners just like you to expand your livable space. Maybe you're looking to increase the investment of your home and maximize your return. Maybe you're a parent or grandparent looking to expand your livable space because your family is growing and it's not a feasible option to move and upgrade. If you have a unique situation or one just like one of these, call Sonoma County Sunrooms today and schedule a free in-home consultation and customize your options. Ask that smartphone of yours to call Sonoma County Sunrooms or visit SoCoSun.com today.
You could go to school for 3 to 5 years to earn the degree you need for the career you want. Or you can go to Empire College and start your career in just 6 to 18 months. Like you, Empire College students have jobs, families, and lots of life going on. But they, like you, want more. More time with friends and family, more time for vacations, more time working in a rewarding career, more time for life, not more time in school. Empire College is Sonoma County's original career technical college. North Bay employers and graduates know why more than 80% of Empire College students are referred by family and friends. Want even more? How about a free education from Empire Business College? Apply today at empirefreeeducation.com. Make 2020 the year you get more. Apply now at empirefreeeducation.com. All entries due by February 14th. Get more life at Empire College.
Hey, Sonoma County. This is George Adair with Cross Country Mortgage. This is a great time for many homeowners to refinance and use your home's equity to pay off credit cards, complete home improvement projects, or just lower your payment with a new fixed-rate mortgage. Just visit georgiadair.com for a fast pre-approval. Then I'll provide a free phone or in-person consultation, reviewing your goals and potential savings. Cross Country offers amazing technology, incredible rates, and a local presence you can trust. Even more important, I have the experience and loan programs to help get your loan approved even with challenging credit or income situations. We're a direct lender, and many of our clients close their refinance loan in as fast as 21 days. Some properties don't even require an appraisal. If you're ready for a great lending experience, then let's get started. Call me direct at 707-583-8100. That's 707-583-8100. Or visit georgiadair.com.
Cross Country Mortgage, NMLS ID 2039, and Georgia Dare, NMLS ID 245370. Equal housing lender, subject to credit approval.
In the KSRO kitchen with Paul Friedman, author of American Cuisine, brand new. First book, The 10 Restaurants That Changed America, several years ago. Chef John Ash and I, Steve Garner in the kitchen. And part two, Modernity. Boy, that was a big chapter and a really important chapter, how technology changed how we eat in 100 years.
So I was interested both in technology like refrigerated railroad cars, or new ways of making things like cookies and bread. Frozen foods was the big post-war technology. But also in the attitudes that Americans had that welcomed these innovations and that found these innovations time-saving, inexpensive, and reliable.
Well, I remember that somebody described TV dinners as an example as something that was going to free the American housewife from the tyranny of the kitchen.
Yeah, so food companies did not have an interest in telling housewives that cooking is fun. Because if cooking was fun, then they'd buy the raw ingredients. And the food companies don't make money off of raw ingredients. Mm-hmm. They make money off the mixes and the processed foods. So a lot of what they advertise is not just that this is convenient, but that this is convenient and will make your life bearable.
But also lower prices, you point out, and availability convinced Americans, why bother to cook?
Or for the perception of lower prices. In fact, instant mashed potatoes are more expensive than buying the potatoes, but they're not very expensive. Mm-hmm. So certainly the perception would be that your time, even if you were not working outside the home, that you have other things to do. And moreover, that your husband, while he wants nice meals, does not want somebody who is slaved all day in the kitchen. And so the food companies present an image of the bedraggled housewife who, yeah, she may have produced a great meal, but she doesn't look very attractive. And so her husband may start thinking of her as a kind of servant.
The husband wants her to look like June Cleaver with her pearls when he comes home and have dinner on the table.
At a minimum, June Cleaver, or maybe even a little sexier. But he also doesn't want scratch meals. Mm-hmm. So that's where the food companies think that they come in, that they offer meals that everybody loves, but you won't break a sweat making them.
So you also talk about the rise of the supermarket, and I'll quote something you said, which I thought was really interesting. It's that despite their kaleidoscope of offerings, supermarkets actually limit choice.
Well, they limit choice in two senses. One is that although they've got an average of 50,000 products, they've all got Oreos. You know, they've all got Tropicana orange juice. And so just like with the community cookbooks, if you're inside a supermarket, you don't know where you are. You won't know whether the Whole Foods is in Seattle or Miami.
I like what you wrote on page 170-71, and I'll just read it. You wrote, well-established products made by large food companies may be fading in popularity, but entire categories that purport to be healthful but are just as industrially produced as Doritos flood the aisles. High-end pancake mix, gluten-free pasta, energy drinks, breakfast bars, coconut water, and kale chips are just a few examples. Tastes have become significantly more sophisticated as restaurants proliferate and diners seek out authentic and flavorful foods.
Right, but they also seek out still convenient foods or things like energy bars that are food without going to the trouble of preparing food. And, of course, the most important factor is that we cook much less than we used to. So at one time in the 1950s, whatever you might say about the poor taste of the era, people cooked at home.
Modern dining, fast foods, that's one of the next chapters you address. And starting back with Fred Harvey in the 1876 area, and then in Howard Johnson in the 1960s, and McDonald's, whose influence is kind of on the wane as other healthy alternative fast foods have kind of made an impact, haven't they?
And the very idea of healthful alternative fast foods or high-quality alternative fast foods is a very dynamic concept. You see this in Shake Shack, Sweetgreen, Chipotle.
And here, Amy's fast food has opened up in California, and that's changing the landscape a lot.
Definitely. So if you can provide the convenience, low price, proliferation, you know, there's one nearby, and actually give people the sense that they're eating something that they know what the ingredients are, or the ingredients look like they're healthful, or there's plenty of kale, or whatever it is, then yeah, that's a winning formula.
Dieting, I put a big star by that. You said the most radical and long-lasting food reform idea was the denigration of taste, the deterioration of taste, that dieting became so important.
Yeah, so once you identify food that is good for you, but for invisible reasons, like it has vitamins, then taste is no longer a reliable guide to what's good for you. And you get what still is the current formula that if it tastes good, it's probably not good for you. So I think Americans would probably be happier and perhaps more healthful if we weren't so obsessed by this. This is a country in which there's more diet advice per capita than anywhere else, but a country with a very high obesity rate.
You talk in the next chapter about ethnic restaurants, which I really love, because we think we know what that is. But you made a little short comment in there, which I thought was really interesting, that I'd love you to talk about. Authenticity is fragile.
So-called ethnic restaurants, and I use the term because that preserves the somewhat superior attitude of the customer. The customer may think of himself or herself as a food adventurer, but it assumes that those restaurants are just there for their delectation and pleasure, which they are, but they're also there to sell them stuff. And the restaurateurs themselves have more agency or power than we think. They know what people do and do not like who are Americans. So there's a wonderful line that I quote from a food vendor in New York who is making Salvadorian pupusas. And she says, "In my country, actually, these would not have vegetables in them. But blanquitos, white people, blanquitos like vegetables, so, you know, what?" So that's all playing with authenticity. You adjust a seemingly authentic mi tierra kind of dish in order to satisfy customers who don't really know what the product is. Another way of manipulating authenticity that I mentioned is that a chain in the New York area called Xi'an, X-I-A-N, the city in China, Xi'an Famous Foods, which, by the way, has wonderful stuff. But for a long time, they hired cashiers who didn't know English in order, their owner said, to increase the authenticity.
There was a beautiful menu reproduction on page 260, the New Orleans House souvenir menu, New Orleans House Restaurant in Louisville, Kentucky, 1961. Eclecticism or confusion. The New England clam bake at this New Orleans-style restaurant in Kentucky includes gumbo. The reason I thought this was so entertaining is every birthday I ate at this restaurant.
No kidding.
Oh, yes. It was my go-to restaurant.
Oh, my God. I should have interviewed you. So the idea here is the limits of regionality of a restaurant in Louisville, Kentucky that calls itself a Louisiana restaurant, yep, and that's offering a New England clam bake. Wow. I need to know what you had.
Well, I didn't care. All I knew was that I could eat as many shrimp as I wanted.
The next major section, the third major section, you called the Great Transformations. And they're too many to talk about, but a couple of them that I think I found really interesting were, number one, the waning of French authority over food. My training a long time ago, of course, you went to France to learn because that was the pinnacle Western food, but that's not the case anymore.
Yes, so the decline of French control over international high cuisine is, in my opinion, the big story of the last 50 years internationally. 50 years ago, the New York Times guide to restaurants in New York City, all of the four-star restaurants with one exception, the Coach House, which purported to have American food, but all of the others were French. And you'd get the same thing in any city in the 19th and the 20th century. So for well over 200 years, haute cuisine and French cuisine were the same thing. One of the reasons that I had the Four Seasons in the restaurants book as one of the 10 restaurants that changed America was that in 1959, it deliberately tried to offer high-end cuisine that was not French. And so the fact that now French cuisine is just one more of a world cuisine, that the most expensive restaurants in New York or San Francisco are Japanese and Italian and not exclusively or even primarily French, that France has lost the ability to define what is and what is not high cuisine.
We'll continue with The Great Transformation, part three of Paul Friedman's new book when we return. The new book is called American Cuisine and How It Got This Way. Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash in the KSRO kitchen.
Bennett Valley hears KSRO on Crystal Clear FM at 103.5.
If you're struggling with weight and frustrated with dieting each and every year, Mark Patrick Hypnosis can help. Join the over 500,000 people who've attended Mark Patrick Hypnosis programs with weight loss results. Mark Patrick Hypnosis will be in Santa Rosa tomorrow. Make that New Year's resolution a reality.
After this hypnosis, I want to eat good food.
Since August, I can honestly say I have not had one potato chip.
It was life-changing for me.
And I don't think about desserts like I used to.
Bridget, how much have you lost now?
I have lost a total of 83 pounds.
Holy cow.
It's easy, it's fun, very relaxing, and very successful.
And I would just say go for it.
For only $49.99, lose all the weight you want, 100% guaranteed. Tomorrow at the Flamingo Resort Hotel and Conference Center. Seminar time is 11 to 1, registration at 10:30. Find out how the power of hypnosis can help you achieve your weight loss goals. Limited seating, arrive early, markpatrickseminars.com.
This is North Bay Biz Country.
The February issue is out, and it's all about health and medicine. This is Lawrence Amaturo, publisher of North Bay Biz Magazine. We're your one-stop shop for hot trends, topics, and issues impacting Napa, Marin, and Sonoma, all in living color, each and every month. Our cover story this month is entitled Plant Power. Veganism is on the rise, and we've got all the stats to prove it. We focus on the rise in plant-based eating across the U.S. and why it's good for both you and our planet. How good is your health care? Costs continue to soar. It's increasingly difficult for people to manage medical bills, and employers are really struggling to offer coverage. We spill in what experts are telling their best clients. And finally, don't forget to fill out the ballot for our 31st annual Reader's Poll. Vote for the best companies in the North Bay, your favorite brewery, accountant, banker, or business-friendly city. You can also vote online at northbaybiz.com. That's northbaybiz.com.
Helping grow your business isn't just something we do, it's all we do.
Does healthy eating habits fit into your New Year's resolution? Then shop the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market for fresh local produce. It's important to know where your food comes from, and you can meet the local farmers and ranchers who raise quality, locally grown food products for you to enjoy. At the market, you can savor a variety of delicious prepared foods. The market offers fresh local ingredients for healthy dinners, a variety of quality meats from beef, chicken, and pork to seafood, along with seasonal fruits and vegetables. Taste the local goat cheeses from Two Rock Valley Goat Cheese. Sample the wonderful baked goods, jams, spices, and pastas. Everything you need to create memorable healthy dinners is at the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market. Open year-round, rain or shine, Saturdays, 8:30 till 1 p.m. at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
In the KSRO kitchen with Steve Garner and Chef John Ash and Paul Friedman, author of American Cuisine and How It Got This Way. So you spoke about the decline of French,
which was cooking. the '70s,
and I think it begins in the '70s,
and it was such a this section really captured me because you open it by saying that the '70s were at the beginning of the 1970s. It was kind of the nadir of American cuisine. But at the same time, all of these things happen that change forever the way we eat today. Hippie food, you know, which you talked about, which I think Yule Gibbons and Adele Davis and all of those people. And then, of course, the California food, California cuisine revolution with Alice Waters and others.
Yes, so the 1970s, I call the magic decade. It was dubbed by Spy magazine the stupid decade. I think it's both. It certainly is the period in which fast food became universal. All off-ramps of interstate highways were full of different fast food chains, and that's what really spread. The microwave oven other kinds of things that continued the beating up of quality dining. But it's also the era of Chez Panisse and other examples of restaurants that emphasized the quality of the primary ingredients, which was not what had made America great. Emphasizing the primacy of quality, that is, that a tomato ought to taste like a tomato should, means that seasonality and location become important. It means that the industrial food model has to be challenged, because while the industrial food model can deliver hundreds of kinds of tomato products, it can't actually deliver ripe tomatoes, because that's too much, that's not scalable.
So even though hippie food has been the subject of a lot of derision over the years, you point out that small batch, handmade, artisanal, free range, a lot of these ideas began in the 1970s.
Right, and I lived in the Bay Area in the 1970s, so I know how bad a lot of hippie food was. I never really liked brown rice. I didn't even like alfalfa sprouts. And when I moved to when I moved to Tennessee, I was kind of relieved to be out of that zone. Nevertheless, just as you said, Steve, the hippie critique of mass market food culture at least paved the way for people who focused on food not just as healthful or as planet-saving, but as delicious. So Alice Waters is important here. Again, her mother was a health food nut. And so she was rebelling not only against the homogenized and tasteless food provided by the food industry, but against the no-fun model of hippie food. The hippie food still participates in this notion of healthful and non-toxic, and the notion that food is a pleasure, and that a pleasure is a way of subverting the corporate and imperialist world. So for hippies, music was a pleasure, drugs were a pleasure, sex was a pleasure, but food was still a necessity.
You mentioned that you say the most important, perhaps the most important, long-lasting shift was the effect of the so-called Mediterranean diet.
So this is really an enduring thing. And at Yale University, where I teach, the food services tries deliberately to create a Mediterranean diet, by which they mean not only a lot of Middle Eastern dishes and Italian dishes, pizza ovens and things like that, but less emphasis on meat. And less emphasis on butter. And so the Mediterranean diet is the most enduring legacy of things that became popular in the 1970s.
So we have to talk about, because you end the book by talking about the future. So what's going to happen beyond 2020? What's going to happen?
Okay, so I should preface this by saying I'm a historian and not a futurologist.
He looks back, not forward.
Even in the gap between the time I wrote this and the time it was published, things like climate change have become more urgent, and adaptations like Beyond Beef or Beyond Meat and plant-based meat-tasting products have become not only more prominent but accepted by chains like Burger King and Dunkin', so that those are very important developments. Another one that was happening when I wrote it but has lots and lots of successive consequences is the Me Too movement and changes in the nature of celebrity for chefs. I say in the book that, I'm not sure how you can have nice chefs out of the model of chefs that we've had before or out of the reality of the kitchens, acknowledging that you, Chef Ash, are an unusually nice guy, but you're not under the pressure of the kitchen right at the moment. So, I think these are trends that clearly are underway and will have a bright future.
Well, and to that point, you also talk about the effect on large food companies, which I think we're already seeing. that a lot of these companies, which have been iconic for the last 30, 40 years or so, they're not doing so well.
No, Campbell's Soup, for example, or McDonald's, as we spoke about, they have not been able to attract a health-conscious middle-class audience, and they have not wanted to limit themselves to their base. And so they, their profits are declining. The middle aisles of the supermarket, which have the processed foods, are declining. The canned foods are declining, the frozen foods. Their strategies include a more healthful image, buying small companies that have a following. Mm-hmm. But they have trouble running these companies because, once again, their whole model is large scale, mass market, and we're in the process of not having a mass market anymore.
That was an interesting fact. The number of restaurants is growing at twice the rate of population increase. So more and more people want to eat out? Or
we spend more money now. I think 2016 was the first year of this. A greater amount of money is spent in eating food made by other people, whether that's takeout or restaurants or fast food or delivery, than we do cooking at home. I would say, logically, there ought to be a return to cooking at home for reasons of health, control, the young generations liking to know where their food comes from, but it hasn't happened yet.
And the rise of meal kits.
Yeah.
I wonder how that's going to...
Meal kits are sort of a compromise.
It seems like they made a big splash and now they're fading.
I think
away.
They're the worst of both worlds. They're not particularly cheap and they're not particularly creative. But what do I know?
Yeah. So you have a page which I don't think you authored, but somebody else did. But I'm glad you included it about what's in and what's out.
Yeah. Well, I put it in there, but I was quoting, I think, the...
From Wall Street Journal.
The Wall Street Journal. Yeah. So this is as of 2018, at least. So hearty things like brisket of beef or duck are in. Japchae, which are Korean stir-fried noodles. What's out is avocado toast.
Yay!
which they say explicitly, so 2017. kale has become too popular. Mm-hmm. Veal, part of the decline of meat, also cruelty to little animals. And then microgreens. I'm not sure if this is my comment. I think it is, not the Wall Street Journal's. It's been discovered belatedly that microgreens don't taste like anything.
I love the last line in the book, Paul. The great aspect about the United States generally is the exuberance of its people. And despite the many negative peculiarities of food in this country, that high-spirited approach is a saving grace.
I think that goes for all aspects of American life. There are a lot of things I don't like about not only the current, but sort of the long-term life, politics, attitudes here. But you can't deny that it's always entertaining.
Your favorite number today, Paul, between 1 and 12?
8.
Caller number 8 at 636-1350 will win this autographed copy of the brand new book by Paul Friedman, American Cuisine and How It Got This Way. And you should probably pick up the other book, 10 Restaurants That Changed America, while you're at it. John Ash, Steve Garner, we'll see you next week in the KSRO Kitchen.